This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by The Automatic Age. The Automatic Age is the story of a father and son navigating an automated apocalypse, fighting robot search teams through a once perfect utopia of automats, self-driving cars, food pills, and nostalgia machines. They must evade the new protocol, which removes troublesome humans that clutter the world of the future. The Automatic Age is the story of a broken family discovering that what they were forced to leave behind and what they need are not always the same thing.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am your host, Gregory Kamichek. I am here with my long-suffering producer, Dan Vadeboncourt, and my co-hostess with the mostess. I guess you're not a hostess.
No.
But you have the mostess.
Am I not suffering anymore either? Is that?
I don't think you're suffering now. Only, yeah, because Dan had to find all the cords and our microphones because we have not recorded in person. Lo, these how many months?
I want to say it's about a year. I feel like it's about a year.
Oh,
we did do it once or twice, like in the middle of all the stuff, right?
We tried. Summer, yeah, we thought.
Because for a while it was okay and the restrictions were lifted and we went and did it here. But then everything went back into lockdown.
Yes. So now the three of us are sitting masked but not absent to record this season 5 episode of Super Pulp Science. We took a break for summer as we often do, and so fall has come back to the Exchange, a place I haven't come back to for a long time here in Winnipeg. I've been just hunkered down at home, so walk into the studio, coming up the stairs, seeing fall in the Exchange, you know, going to Parlor Coffee and getting coffees for you guys. It just felt so normal, almost normal-ish, so... Man.
It's normal, but it's also new because you haven't done it in a long time.
That's right. So it feels great to be back in the studio. Justin, for those of you who are tuning in and you've never heard our podcast before, Justin and I are writers and illustrators and creatives who make our living selling words and pictures all over this great nation. But Justin also has converted our studio into the greatest shipping and receiving platform you ever did see. And today I will say it looks more like a studio than the last time I was here, where every surface was covered with packing materials.
Yeah, I did clean up. I did some last minute panic. Oh God, other people are coming in here. I need to hide the shame. But yeah, I've learned a lot about packing and shipping the last year. Oh, I feel really good about that area of my business, which was always a shoddy, kind of panicky part of my business. So
yeah, it's like being hungry. You'll learn how to fish.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we've learned so many things. What have you all been up to? You've got a whole list of things you want to talk about.
Yes. Maybe since we ended the last season, I've kept a list of things because I seem to recall the last time we started back up, you asked, what have you been up to? And I was like, I don't know, stuff, right? Like, it's kind of like there's so many conversations with people these days that you haven't seen in a very long time. And of course, the question always comes up, what's new with you? And even though you haven't seen them in 18 months, you're not sure what's new. It kind of blanks. Well, 2020 is like a void year. It's a black hole of
the problem is there's
memory.
Too much that's new. You can't figure out what part of it to tell people.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's also... brushes up against that small talk training that we have where people say, what's new? And you're supposed to say, nothing. And everyone goes, ha, 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 I hate work. And then you just talk about some show or some sports event,
yeah.
Right? Whereas when I'm asking you for the purposes of our listeners what you've been up to, there's actually a real reason. So they can hear how we've suffered to make the things we make. Right? So what have you been up to? What's been going on?
Oh, there's so many. I'm trying to pick like what kind of topic to like personally or professionally or project-wise. You know,
Let's go professional and project-wise.
Okay. Well, let's talk about
Personal life will sneak in.
We had a good little text exchange a month or two ago, where It's been 18 months since we've done a convention, and I was starting to get really antsy about doing a Comic-Con, especially since in the United States, things have opened up and people have started to do conventions again. And here in Canada, nothing really is available Comic-Con event-wise yet.
We will not debate the wisdom of that on these proceedings.
So I found a couple friends of mine from the States who have started like video blogs of their Comic-Con. So I started watching.
Oh no.
Yeah. So it was actually like kind of a bad rabbit hole to tumble down. It was people just showing the process of how they built their booth and all the tricks and tips they've learned and just all the tweaking they've been doing and then the new shows they've been doing this year. And so I started making like this huge list of all this stuff that I wanted to rework in my Comic-Con booth. And then I started like watching older videos of other conventions that I was actually at, but from a different person's perspective and hearing what they had to say about it. And so I started kind of analyzing what made me so hungry for conventions, because it wasn't the financial aspect. It wasn't that I wanted to go to make a paycheck. And so I started talking to Gregory about this, and I was texting some other people too, like trying to figure it out, like what is it that was really driving?
Yeah, and for the dear listener, we were basically trying to unpack what's at the heart of that FOMO, that fear of missing out, like what is really... what's way down there? What is the pearl in the oyster?
And so I think I kind of like I had a bit of a revelation just because I've never really sat and analyzed this part before. But when you go to an artist alley, you're basically like you're all the same shop and you're all setting up your version of the exact same shop. And then you're competing for people's attention to come to your shop. And what I really missed was the competition of booths, the competition of ziggurats of like, here's what I have new this year that's cooler than the booth next to me so I can get more people to come look at me rather than look at you. Because really, we have the same product. We have artwork and books for sale. It's generally the same thing, booth after booth after booth. But you have to be, you know, the prettiest to right. get the crowd to look at you.
I'm reminded of those documentaries of tropical birds. Jungle birds with their foliage in all different varieties. They're just all birds, but they're all trying their best to be the most extravagant and wondrous bird to attract, you know, that attention that
they're
they need.
Competing. Yeah. So it was the competition that I really, really missed. I love making artwork, but it's almost like when you're training to be a boxer, but then you never actually get in the ring. Eventually, you really need to get in the ring
to test it.
Yeah. And that's what I was really starting to hanker for.
So you felt like there was a year of too much training?
And it's not a bad thing, but I think it was just the important takeaway from this is I've kind of figured out what my drive was to do conventions and that was it.
That's interesting to me because that competition is still there online. You just don't see it.
It's
not as direct as like,
yes,
people are still because when they go to a convention, they have so much money to spend on whatever they want to spend, and they don't know what they're going to do see yet. So there's a limited amount of funds. It's the same way that all entertainment things compete for your entertainment dollar, even though they're not the same category. So not everybody's doing the exact same thing. But there's a lot of different aspects to that. So yeah, that's interesting that it's the physical nature of being there in person that makes that manifest. It's not something you feel online. Mm-hmm. So cool.
Yeah. And there's I haven't done a show or anything recently, and so what I've been missing out is that day later or 2 days later effect. Which is, for the dear listener, someone will come to your booth, they'll pick up a book, you know, and people often judge a book by its cover. So they will, you know, they pay their dollars and they leave with that book. But most of those conventions, you've come for a couple of days. And so someone will come back with their actual opinion related to the work. And that unsolicited and unfiltered opinion, I crave it, right? Good and bad. I mean, obviously... most of me prefers the good parts when people really like it. But even when someone comes back and says, you know, it just wasn't what I thought it was. You know, between the slug line and the cover, I thought it was this. I thought it was this flavor, but I thought it was chocolate, but you sold me vanilla, right? And so...
and you do get that online with comments, but it's just not... nearly the same as hearing it in person from somebody.
Yeah, and I basically don't believe anything on the internet. Yeah. So,
this is right, a good Russian or bad, bot that right? said this comment. That's
just
not a real person.
I just assume that someone has something to gain from it. And so I just, you know, whereas someone who's taken their physical self all the way back to have that exchange, you know, that's really... that's the thread that holds the art world together, is actually talking that process and, you know, what did I mean and what was received in the transmission of the work. I just find that to be super valuable. So I've been missing out on that like crazy, which I guess is a good segue into a previous episode. I will leave a blank space so that you, Dan, can put what episode number it is. Please see episode
number 155, the exact episode previous to this one.
What's the matter with you, Frank?
Where Justin and I talk extensively about our search for an agent that we've been...
That was fairly recent. That was, yeah.
That was not long
I was
ago,
just going to say, like, you've given Dan a really arduous task. We have a lot of episodes at this point.
This just goes back a few episodes where we were taking a break and we were both settling down to search again in earnest for an agent. Now, I've been looking for agents for years, and it always runs against the stumbling block that an agent wants a piece of everything, every dollar that comes in, and most of the work that I have that generates money. I've done all that work myself, and it always comes down to some negotiation as to who gets what and what other business, and never found a good fit. Someone who can do all the different genres and is willing to, and this was the most important one, exclude work that I wanted to do myself from their roster. So typically, if you have an agent or representation of any sort, if someone approaches you with something that has a dollar figure attached to it, your response is supposed to be, see my agent. You're not supposed to take that money in. You're not supposed to take do that negotiation yourself, right? It's sort of the not the done thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine because most people don't know their way around those contracts, don't have a lot of experience with those things, but... since I had to do it the hard way, I have 10 years experience ripping apart those clauses and contracts. And so I like to get my hands dirty, and that sets off a lot of people too. So we were complaining about this in that episode. So then it turned out that Dr. Jonathan Ball heard that episode, heard us lamenting about this, then participated on a panel where he was talking to a group of students, and the other guest was an agent, and he heard that agent saying... a whole bunch of stuff that to his ear went like this. He said, this person thinks all the same things are bullshit that Greg thinks are bullshit, is what he said to me. It's like, maybe this is the kind of agent that Greg needs. He did not check with me first. He didn't ask. He didn't whatever. He just then proceeded to say, hey, I know a person who has some manuscripts that you should probably look at. And probably, I would say, one of the first times that an author approached an agent, not for themselves, with nothing to gain personally at all, but just like did someone else a solid. So shout out endlessly to Dr. Jonathan Ball for that. And then he texted me to say, and we were going through a whole bunch of stuff with other news related to heavy metal and our iCollector project. And so buried in this correspondence was this tiny little line that was like, oh, and if you get a email from an agent, it's not a scam. It's a real person. Respond to that. Because when you're in that agent hunt, you start, or people know, you get all kinds of people trying to represent you for money. And that's, P.S., never how it works. An agent doesn't get paid first. They get paid after you get paid. Right.
So the one thing I found, a little side note here, when you're looking for agents, there's a lot of self-publishing companies out there that are kind of disguised as agents. And what they basically are is a printing press that wants new authors to print books with them.
Right.
So they kind of pretend to have, like, we'll publish your book, basically mean pay us to print your book. We'll print you books, and then you're on your own.
Yeah.
But they kind of disguise it like they'll do everything that an agent's going to do for you, but really they're just a printer that wants to print your book.
That's right.
And I accidentally gave my email to one of those and got, like, phone calls, like...
Nonstop, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the worst. Print
your book,
those are called vanity presses, is the popular term for them. Places that are just preying on your vanity. I want to be an author. I want to publish a book. Oh, someone said that they like my work and they'll make it happen. And the contract often includes not being able to talk about the contract. And so then you get locked into this horrible deal. And, you know, what also happens is people... they are public about having found that representation. And then they're ashamed to say, oh, I got scammed. And so they get locked in, you know, not unlike so many of your dear friends who got roped into network marketing things, not your dear friends, but dear listen, multi-level stuff, right? Where you see them like, yes. I'm now the, I run my own business.
Beachbody something or other.
Right. I sell jewelry. Yeah.
And and then they have trouble admitting openly that they were forced to buy the products themselves, right. Warehouse them themselves, and they actually don't have any support from anyone. They now are on their own to sell that product. So same kind of scenario. So all of that cautionary tale is wrapped around the fact that I got an email then from Emmy, who is an agent at Westwood Creative and a very old and respected and well-established Canadian literary and creative agency. They represent actors and musicians and authors and all kinds of things. And basically said, a little birdie told me that you might have a manuscript. And this is an important thing to say, that it wasn't, hey, let's talk about anything. Let's talk about what kind of person you are. Let's talk. None of that. A little birdie told me you might have a manuscript. Why don't you tell me a little about that manuscript and send it to me, then we'll talk. Right? And that is what an agent should be asking you. And
there should be some vetting, not right. How much can you give me or how much money are you willing to spend to make this book happen?
That's right. The vetting comes from, there's nothing to talk about if I don't like the book.
Exactly.
If I don't like the book, I can't sell the book. If I can't sell the book, I can't get paid. That's the agent's job, is to also pay their own bills. And so they have to have those things into consideration. So it's a very nervous moment where you realize now, no flowery language, no previous accomplishments, no award or accolade that you may or may not have won matters now. Only the book. And I can tell you two gentlemen that I've never been more self-conscious about my manuscript going essentially naked into the hands of another reader as I was in that moment where it was like, oh, right. I can't like throw a handful of glitter in somebody's eyes, right? And then trick them into liking this book. It really has to work.
But wait, she had already seen some of your work before, unbeknownst to you.
Yes.
And here's my favorite part of the story because I'm involved.
Yes. Yeah, so I sent this email and basically so, nervous is the wrong word, but so exposed I felt. That I said, the top line of the email was, here's the book that is in question. Here's the link to that book. But I couldn't just leave. I'm not made of the stuff that can leave it at that. So I put a list of like, an agent should know the following things, right? If you like this, here's a bunch of other stuff. Here's a link to Dragon Nanny. Here's what I did on Dragon Nanny. Here's a project, Haunted Helpers, that I'm doing with Hannah and Justin also. Here's a thing I'm doing with Heavy Metal. Like I couldn't help it. It was like what you're talking about with the plumage.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I was just like, no, please, I'm a pretty and valuable bird. Please.
A plucked bird showing up. You want some feathers.
Yeah. So I needed some feathers. And one of those feathers has been very interesting. So the short version of the story is that Emmy has a wide taste in projects, a wide experience, a palette when it comes to genre. And so the weird horror stuff fits and the kids book stuff fits. And it was really shaping up to be a great representation. And then also in the email where they broke down, you know, what would work and why it wouldn't. Justin had already laid the groundwork of sending Dragon Nanny to Emmy when he did his list. See previous podcast episode.
Bert, Frank, we have a little problem.
I was really looking forward to sending my next book out to a bunch of agents, but to kind of test the waters, I pitched Dragon Nanny just because it was a finished project and I just wanted to kind of, you know, get used to the whole thing. And Emmy was one of the people that responded to Dragon Nanny saying, and the problem was not that the book had already been published, the problem was the amount of money it had already made. So because of the very clear financials on the Kickstarter, they could see exactly how much this book had made already. So that kind of deflates the excitement of a publisher taking it up. They were very, very excited about it, but it wouldn't work and they were basically gave me the open door to submit something in the future. And then a month later, Gregory and J-Ball
had like, sent the project back onto their radar. And so here it was this, well, and I'll also say this, for those of you who are listening to this and say, wait, wouldn't a successful Kickstarter prove that there is a market for a book? Traditional publishing is run in large part by accountants, right? Cost in versus reward out, right? There is a creative, all the gates are creative. The work has to be good to get past the gate. But once you're past the gate, financials matter. And so an accountant looks at a market share. And perhaps the market share has already been served by the Kickstarter. And so the remaining market share might not be enough for them to make their investment back on a book. So this is part of why, while self-publishing through Kickstarter is amazing because the creator gets paid more, you're gambling a little bit more with larger publishers where if it is a big success, it can be an enormous success. But if it isn't, then, you know, they leave you on the curb with your beat up suitcase and a crumpled hat.
But I do think it got me much further into the door.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, like a couple agents did get back to me, and what it did was we have to pass on Dragon Nanny, but whatever you have next, like send it. Like they were excited about what was coming next.
So. And so I went through my email. You turned out you had forwarded me. So since we last talked about this, you had forwarded me the agent response with a little thing that was where you were a little bit disappointed. And it was Emmy's email that said, like it, but have to pass. Mm-hmm. So in my correspondence with my new agent, the conversation went this way. Gushing about how great Dragon Nanny was as a project and how talented Justin was as an illustrator and a co-creator. And man, they had to kick themselves to pass on a book like that, but it's just how publishing works. And so I think one of my plumages was that, you know, we share a studio, we're always working on projects together. When they look at not just that we did Dragon Nanny together, but we've done Rust and Water together, we did Cassie and Tong together, we have an existing relationship that if you're a person who is trying to sell things up the chain of command into the stratosphere of publishing, those existing relationships where people have made plans, finished books, delivered them on time, right, is the kind of thing that's easy to sell. You know, so I'm very proud to say that I have found this, you know, this new pathway for my writing. But also one of the things that we discussed a lot was what I can leave out. For example, Red Earth would be a project where I didn't know what it was going to be. And for the dear listener, it was a graphic novel. We turned it into a theater production. It was a big multimedia experiment. It was great. But it was the kind of thing where if I'd had an agent, it would have got in the way of every step of that project because the creative team was pivoting so often towards what we could accomplish rather than a plan. We were experimenting at that time. So you didn't always know what form it would take. So you couldn't have an agent come in and put a lengthy contract and make everyone sign an initial because it wouldn't have been nimble. And so one of the things I said was, you know, people like Andreas Artisan, if they phone me up and say, Greg, I have a crazy idea for a project, do you want in? I want to be able to say yes and not have to say, well, you'll have to talk to my agent. And so, you know, we put in writing what that looks like and how that works and how those exclusions will be handled. And that put me at such ease as far as being able to say, this I want to give to my agent, this I'm going to do myself, this I'm going to do with a collaborator, and all the things that were missing up until then.
It's great that you have that flexibility. I was going to ask you, like, now that you have an agent, do you have to use that agent for everything you do? And obviously the answer is no.
No.
You can choose what you want to go through the agent, what you want to put through other channels. So I think that's great that you have. Because I've heard of people having those conversations where you have to talk to my agent, and they're pretty, like stiff on that. That is the only option for that person.
Yeah.
They go through their agent, and that's it. Yeah. So it's good that you're not, you're keeping that flexible.
Well, each according to their gifts, too. Some people just don't want
to do that. Right, and the agent, for some people, the agent just helps the situation so much. Yeah. They just would rather have that experience and not have to deal with anything themselves. So that's why they say that. But yeah, I like that the flexibility allows you to pick and choose what you want to.
It also came at that very important time where normally, you know, Justin or I or anyone in the studio here, we'd be working on a project. We'd be planning our Kickstarter. We'd be planning to take it to shows. We'd be figuring out the logistics of selling it before it's finished. And then we'd have a very short window, maybe a couple of months, to finish a project, think about it, and then take it on the road. Well, along comes lockdown, where I'm now finishing projects. And rather than going through all of that normal life cycle, they're just finished and waiting now. And so if that continues or persists, I want to be able to have a place where those finished projects, while I'm sleeping, can be being shopped around. Or while I'm working on the next project, you know? Mm-hmm. So the manuscripts that Emmy's shopping around right now, those are off of my mind while I work on iCollector full bore right now. So it becomes a way to also partition my energy, which because we're homeschooling, well, we have the kids out of school during the lockdown and the subsequent, who knows how schools are working, it just means that we have that flexibility, so...
Cool.
Hooray for us.
Yeah.
Also, for Hannah, who, you know, is our secret weapon on Haunted Helpers, which we're also working out the representation for that book.
Yeah, such a fun project.
Yeah.
I still, like, there exists somewhere in one of my boxes of shame in the back room or at my condo, the original sketches for Haunted Helpers. It originally started as a ghost and a skeleton lived in the house, and they got bored of playing checkers night after night, and they wanted more friends. And so they cleaned up the house to try to turn it, like, just to get people to trick-or-treat there or something like that. And then you ran with it and made a whole rhyming book.
Yeah, we spent 3 days doing nothing but rhyming. Now, here's an amazing thing about that rhyming. So I wrote
editing.
The verses, then Justin started storyboarding, then Hannah came in and, like...
You had the final script, and then I had 3 hours to storyboard it out in time for you to read it to your kids as a bedtime story.
Man, it was so great. So now all this comes around back into the grist of the mill of how publishing works. So one of the big things you'll find all over online, and it's true, if you're pitching a kid's book to... publishers in the sort of the big five, you know.
First of all, that's probably the most competitive market. Everybody's got a kid's book.
Absolutely.
Is it really?
Super competitive.
A lot of editors have a big, all caps, not accepting kids' books at this time.
Because people perceive that children's books are easier.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there is also a giant, all bolded caveat, no rhyming books in many cases.
Which I didn't understand
until
Gregory
wrote a rhyming book. And so one of the feedbacks, pieces of advice we get back from the agent, of course, which I anticipate, and I was talking to them about anticipating this feedback, was that, like the book, do you think we can change it so it doesn't rhyme, right? And my point of view on that is, yes, the message is strong, and the real, like, the majority of the hard work is Hannah's. So how dare I now be like... Well, if you don't like how I rhyme these two words together, then no book deal for anyone, right? What a silly stance to take.
Actually, the one stance I'm going to take on that book is there is a page in Haunted Helpers that there's a big door that says keep out on it. And there's fingerprints on the ground that kind of look like they've slapped the ground and then were dragged into the room. And we have jam by the door to make it look like it's... It's jam, but it's actually kind of gruesome, and I love that. And that's the kind of thing that, like, growing
that's
up,
your deal breaker. That's
if they want to get rid of that,
all
I'm
right,
out.
Let's put that. Let's hear it's on the podcast. So, you know, a year from now, when we've changed that page, because you know, maybe Scholastics is interested in the book, then you'll know how deep our principles.
The first
go.
Notes I got about the book as well, I think from, like, my nephews, maybe your kids as well, everybody wanted to know what's in that room. Like, that was the only question they had at the end of the book. What was in the keep out room?
Yeah.
What happened?
And isn't that the best thing? It's like when you look at Mercer Mayer books, there's always hidden, weird, creepy stuff going on in the background that you'd never get explained. The other thing that I really love about this new wrinkle for us is that it doesn't preclude anything we've been doing up until now. All it does is it pushes off the decision for about 12 months where a book is finished, then we shop it upriver, and then we bring it back and say, okay, well, a big publishing house isn't interested in backing this book, but it doesn't mean that we can't print 2,000 copies and sell them at shows ourselves. It doesn't exclude that same planning. So it turns our pitch season into something where we decide what goes up, what stays with us, what gets reworked. So
it's another avenue. Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
There they are.
His body's in there?
Speaking of exciting, I designed two beer labels.
That's so
since
cool.
Since we last talked.
I mean, I don't even drink beer, and that's cool.
I do drink beer, and I'm trying to find the beers.
They were both limited editions, and I think they both like got snatched up pretty quickly. But the one will be
probably
recreated.
Because the art's so good. Like, I don't know about the beer, but yeah. The art is so good.
But I
was looking for them. When I saw you tweeting about that, I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. And I always kept my eye out whenever I go to the beer store, but I didn't see it. And it was probably flew off the shelves.
So in Manitoba, I think we're a little behind the times with just how the legislation of a microbrewery works. But like a couple of years ago, like 10 years ago, there was only kind of the big breweries in town. And then some laws changed so all these microbreweries could start up. So there's all these little beer labels, and we have them just everywhere in the city now. Yeah. Like there's just a ton of them. And I've always wanted to make a beer label. And of course, I've never applied or reached out to make a beer label. So how dare nobody like just offer me one out of the blue? So I just went on, I think just through Instagram, I just direct messaged a whole bunch of the local breweries. Like, I'm a local artist. You can look at my art here. I'd love to do a label if there's some like opportunity there. And I think three immediately came back with, yes, let's work together. Like, here's the schedule.
Right.
And then another one or two are like, reach back later. We totally want to do something. We just don't have anything going right now. So the first one I did was with Vessel, who is a subsidiary of Nonsuch. So Nonsuch is like their main beer. They're like their bread and butter. And then Vessel is this kind of side company they have that does experimental beers. And every label is done by a local artist, and the local artist gets 10 cents a can for sales. So if your beer is good and it sells a lot, you can make a really decent paycheck.
Rural, yeah.
And so their idea or their name.
So let me just ask a question. Yeah. Did they give you only the royalty? Like the
So they have a guaranteed amount they're going to make.
So they have a flat rate.
So they have a flat rate, which was fair.
And if you go above it.
And if I go above it, it's.
What a
gravy.
Big deal. Now, was that the way they normally work? Or
that has been like from the get-go, yes.
Okay.
So the only thing I added on is I also wanted to make prints of the piece and sell at conventions. And they were more than okay with that as long as they got a couple too.
Right.
So I did Rumble and the Crumble, which is a raspberry crumble beer, which was really good. It doesn't sound... When they first described it, like, I don't know.
I'm not a beer drinker. Yeah. So that sounds great to me.
Yeah. But it's not too sweet, not too anything. It was a delicious beer. And then because it was like Rumble in the Crumble and I really like boxing, I made these two robot boxers. And then on the back, I have them like, actually, it's almost like a stop motion fight of them fighting surrounding like the logo. And then right before they went to print, they're like, we just... discovered with our label maker that we can do kind of shiny foil. Do you know, like, are you interested in this?
Are you interested in foil?
And I'm like, oh my God.
Instagram.
Like, I am all about the foil printing this last year. So I know exactly how this works and how to like best like implement foil into these robot
so the
characters.
So the can itself had foil on it?
So they basically can print kind of a transparency on the label. So the shininess of the can comes through the label.
Wow.
So you get these shiny bits. So like all these little like camera flashes behind the robots and the highlights on the robots are actually shiny. So when you walk by it on like the shelf, like it looks like it's shiny.
Right. That's amazing. Yeah. I have this image right now of like a whole bunch of people at a little microbrewery sitting around at a table, and they are like how we used to be with our cereal boxes. You know, you'd be you'd be reading the cartoon or turning the box to like, you know, have all that entertainment that used to be included on the back of cereal boxes, but now it's on their beer, you know, like they've all grown up, but oh, here it is again.
And so here's the other thing that really got me excited, just going through this process and dealing with breweries, is all these short-run breweries, they use like generic kind of tall cans, and they have basically this big sticker label that gets attached. And that's pretty common. If you're not printing huge amounts, it doesn't make sense to make like a legit beer can. You kind of you do a normal can, you put a sticker on it.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about like when we get back to doing events or art shows or something like that, approaching a brewery, not to do a new beer, but take one of their existing beers
and relabeling
it just for a small amount for a custom event.
You say for the show, like we're going to sell beer at the, you're like, we'll sell beer at the convention.
Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
But like, think of a book launch with the themed beer from the book.
Or a FanQuest event where all the FanQuest stuff is there.
Yeah.
Because you can
all
still.
All stuff is beer.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a great tie-in. That is absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you some questions. Yeah. When you were designing an illustration that you know is going to be wrapped on a curvature, mm-hmm. was that in your front brain? Were you like, oh, I want to make sure that it's sort of divided into what is essentially thirds because your eyes are
yeah,
see
you
the
kind
center.
Of it's one long piece, but then you kind of have to split it into strips and think of like a strip as a piece by itself,
like a 30 degrees of that illustration.
Yeah, because you're usually looking at one strip at a time.
Yeah,
right. You're just going from one strip to the other to the yeah. other. You're never. Yeah, you don't think about...
There's no panoramic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think of it as kind of like a bunch of individual strips and how those are going to wrap around the can.
So in a way, it was like doing comics, but on a beer can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And was there any kind of direction from the client on this? Or did they say, hey, just do what you want?
This one, it was do what you want. Okay. Wow. And so the gentleman I was dealing with at Vessel is a graph designer and artist. So we got to talk shop and like got along super well. The other beer label I did was Cobra Chicken from Half Pints. And so they had a very, the Cobra Chicken meme, for those of you who don't know, is this meme that went around the internet, was fairly viral a year or two ago, about a guy from Mexico was working in Canada with a bunch of people on construction or whatever, and he had to go over to the side of the construction site to like go get this pile of whatever, and there was a bunch of Canadian geese there, and he'd never seen Canadian geese before, and he didn't have the strongest grasp of the English language yet, so he went over and the geese of course hissed and chased him.
Yeah, for those of you who think Canada geese are like
cuddly,
not a big deal, they are no joke.
They are very aggressive, right? And
like 60 pounds
scared
of
nothing.
Yeah.
So they hissed and chased this guy away, and so he went back to his buddies, and he's trying to explain to them, like, I don't like the Cobra Chicken. And so the guy tweeted this, and it went all over the internet, and so we made a beer based off of that joke. And so they wanted half chicken, half cobra beer, which I kind of took in a more... I just made an epic Canadian goose rather than a half chicken.
That's what I would right.
half.
That feels like that's kind of what you're, because it really yeah. is a Canadian goose
yeah.
you're talking
yeah.
about.
So that one, like I negotiated and kind of like pushed back on like, it's going to look silly to have a, like a chicken with a cobra head. Can I just make an epic Canadian goose? Because they're already
right.
so cool looking yeah. and like a very
and also
like.
Also it underlines, it takes the fact that it was technically incorrect English, right? But it takes the poetic way in which language describes an object, right, and makes it more real. Like those of you who have never seen a Canada goose, Cobra Chicken is pretty perfect.
Yeah.
Doesn't get better than that. Also, just as dangerous, just not quite poisonous. Actually, should we start maybe a rumor that Canada geese are poisonous?
They will break the skin with those beaks. Bites are no joke.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, look up those of you who are not believing us, who are from different climates, you can look up Canada goose attacks. And there's some great ones where they get into people's cars and like the entire carload of like big burly fellas just run for their lives.
What the hell is in those bags?
Rabid weasels.
Since we last spoke, just trying to think if that's true. Yeah, I finished Moon Patrol, or at least first draft.
Pretty epic.
Moon Patrol. Yeah,
so long, too.
Yeah, 400 and some pages. I'm probably going to cut 30 pages or so from it. I've decided that rather than add pages to it to make it make more sense, I'm just going to prune it until it looks like the right shape that I want. So unless I get some feedback from a publisher that they want this, that, or the other thing, then I'm gonna follow the rule that you only make changes for editorial purposes. So it's big, it's done, it got me through the lockdown. I feel like a healthy, new, better artist. So that's kind of feels good to just set that aside and like back it up in like 40 different places. What do you? We were talking before the podcast about file trees, and I'll yes. apologize to anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about. We're going to go a little nerdy and a little pedantic here. But one of the things I figured out, if I have a mess of old files and I'm trying to keep track of them, these are Photoshop files in particular, I'm pretty bad at naming them properly or dating the file in the name or any of those things. And so what I've realized to do is I went through and I inventoried a bunch of old hard drives using InDesign. So I went through the old hard drives and I linked all of those images to InDesign files and made a giant index. Because now when I'm like...
So that InDesign file is just random whatevers.
No, I organized it by sort of theme.
Okay.
Like I organized it how I think. So when I'm like, oh, I remember that it was red and oh, it had a robot and oh, it had a dragon. You know, like that sounds crazy. But I organize it visually like that. Because if I remember the colors or I remember the contents, it's very easy to find within that individual InDesign file now, even if it's a few hundred pages long. But then when I click on the image on that page, all of the data and metadata information about where that file is, where it's stored, when I made it, it's all there.
And even if you move the folder around, you have the exact file name.
That's
so
right.
You can just search for that exact That's file right. name rather than try to remember what the heck you named
yeah.
it.
So for newer projects, of course, I'm trying to get better and better at organizing it well and properly. When you're kind of doing everything yourself and sort of like making it up as you go, you can, as long the finished result is what matters. But now that I'm working with more collaborators and more people who have to see the thing, it's more important to kind of keep it organized. But it doesn't mean that I don't have a bunch of books that aren't out yet that weren't made in that old salad bar method. And so this is something. But you've been doing something different. You had like... embedded files or something?
So, yeah, well, it's kind of a, I think I screwed up with embedding files. So for those of you who don't know, InDesign is the program that you kind of, you make books with. So it lays out all these files onto pages, and it doesn't take the entire art file and plop it into InDesign. It just kind of copies the location of that main file, so you don't end up with an InDesign file that's gigs and gigs and gigs. It just basically has a like a preview of what's attached. And so when you're working with a really big document that's got files all over your computer, you can also, you have the option to embed the entire file into InDesign.
Yeah, and this is an aside. This is useful if you have some in a cloud somewhere that you're storing and some on your file and some on a thing. You can have them all open that one day and it'll suck it all as you're exporting the file into one place and put it all in a place you can use it. So that's why people do it that way, for those of you who are wondering.
But then I couldn't figure out, so I did that with a whole bunch of smaller images that I knew embedding wasn't going to like make my file too huge. So I embedded them all, but then... this book was supposed to be printed like a year ago, and so I'm going back now, and I'm trying to edit these embedded files, and I had a huge issue trying to edit them all, because they needed, yeah, I needed to change basically some stuff in Photoshop and change their color, like they were RGB, I had to change them to CMYK, and I can't edit them all because they're embedded.
So to clarify, instead of a preview that will take you to the file which you can edit, it was the actual
Yeah, there is no
image.
File anywhere anymore.
Right.
It's embedded.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out that. So I had like just a, it was a art book file that I'd been working on for a long time, kind of stop go, and it was just a mess of a file. So my last like 3 days, this art book went to print today, early this morning, and the last couple days have just been me trying to track down all these files that I needed to kind of unembed and edit and then relink, and it was just a disaster. So if you have a huge document, don't embed a bunch of things. It'll lead to disaster.
How amazing was that feeling, though, at first, when you can remember, you were like, oh, I'll just embed it in here. And you thought you'd solved a major problem.
It seems like a good idea.
It does, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is a good idea if you're going to print tomorrow, right? But like you say, if you're leaving it for a while and you might make some adjustments, or as you know, Justin often will revisit an old composition and adjust the colors or the levels or the, you know, push things a little that way. Working in Vector gives him that power.
Yeah, don't. So I just am. I'm not going to embed. I'm just going to be better at keeping track of my files from now on. Is basically the moral of that story. Yeah.
File management. And it's funny because when you're, you know, in my case, when you're at home, not at the studio, trying to figure out where everything is, did I store it on a backup that I leave here at the studio? Did I store it, whatever? Trying to figure out where everything was as I'm inventorying what I have available, which came up, of course, because much of my back catalog that I've worked on that wasn't work for hire, I retained the rights to or reclaimed the rights to in recent years. And so inventorying that stuff so that you can pass it to your agent and say, these are also books that are already finished that maybe there's another life for, right? Trying to go through and find the proper print files,
right,
of those things meant that I was for, there was like 3 days where I was like, oh, I guess those books don't exist anymore. I guess they're gone. I wonder, could I just scan the original, like, right. Scan the pages that were printed in this version of it? No, that won't work.
Or even right now, there's a couple books that I'm going to be making available digitally online. So I need to reopen the actual end file and make a digital PDF for people to download. And so in most recent books, the trick I learned is at the very end of your book, take a couple minutes and do final kind of file organization. And what I mean by that is take all the like working files and stuff like that and put it in a folder called working files, and then have like a final printed book printed September 24th, 2021. Like label those final files really obviously and have everything else kind of tucked away. Because when I would go into old folders, they would just be like a mess of versions, like final, 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 Yes. Yeah.
For sure. This is really the final one.
You know, right now, there is probably a very precise, you know, type A is maybe feels a little like an insult, but there's a type A person out there who hates our guts for even suggesting that we could live like this. How dare you, gentlemen?
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains.
Brains only.
Yes.
The final printed page, for the most part, is what matters. However you got it there, if you have that final flattened image that you're not going to change, more power to you. But if you ever want to do a French translation, a Spanish translation of a comic or graphic novel, you want to make sure your lettering is on separate layers than your art, or you may find yourself in trouble.
You're resizing the book. Suddenly right. You have to make the book 2 inches bigger than you thought.
Yeah.
And so you need access to that native file.
Yeah. And one thing that I was telling to my letterer, who is probably listening right now, Lyndon, do you hear me? He is now in France. And
yeah,
so
this
he was
podcast isn't in French. He won't get it anymore.
No, we're just so ignorant that we can't speak in French. If you look at a lot of bande dessinée, the word bubbles are perfectly round, right, or perfectly square, because a lot of those comics have been translated in multiple languages. And so it's just a big white space where you have room to fit any number of versions. Our friend James at Canada Histories Magazine was letting me know that if you're laying out text for English and then you have to lay out text, that same text to be in French, is about 30% more room you need.
Oh.
Right? Mm. So kind of like what was happening with your Spanish-speaking fellow there in your Cobra Chicken, right? That certain words, to be more specific, right, are descriptive. And so certain things balloon. You know, our truncated English that it like just steals from everything and smashes it into a little space doesn't work on the broader translation market. So these are things that, you know, if you want to figure out how to make your book look good in other places to consider, that are new for us to consider.
Yeah, somebody told me at one point, when you're building a big file, keep in mind, like, just build it as if somebody else is going to have to come in years later and figure it out. And if it's, like, just a mess of stuff that, like, because when you come back a couple years later, you're going to have no idea what you were doing at that time. So you need to leave it in a state that, you know, if you get hit by a bus tomorrow, somebody can go in and figure out exactly what the final, you know, good boys file is right to print. Not have to wade through seas of final, 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 two, final, final, three.
Yeah. The one function that I find is the greatest asset when you're trying to do that, if you have a lot of stuff going on your hard drive or in, you know, wherever you're storing your stuff, is the date added. I often am switching between the names of the files to the date added, because if I know, because I also have a schedule, so I have a pretty strict schedule that I'm working on, so I can look and say, like, okay, last Wednesday I was working on it, I switched to date added, I looked to last Wednesday, there's the file I was working on, I know it was for that book. Because I have, you know, like you, three or four, or sometimes five different things happening at the same time, and so, you know.
I usually use the most recent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was whatever I was last working on. It's just most recent. Okay, there it is.
There it is. That's so, what you're using. For audio files, is this the same? Yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, I mean, you're using a Mac? Are you talking about...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same kind of searching, same kind of naming and that kind of stuff.
So you teach at a college that has graphic design students. What is... You know, we've been just talking about how we made up a bunch of shit. What's the actual thing you guys are teaching the young minds to organize these digital files?
We're not.
There doesn't seem... Well, there is no, like, golden... I don't remember there ever being, like, a golden system. It's, like,
no,
just...
No, because it's so complicated for everybody. Like, every program is different and has its own quirks. And what I was going to... This came up... You're right. We were talking about this before the podcast because I was going to bring up how my students are freaking out over file names when they don't really matter at this point. At this point in the program, we're just trying to teach them how to do the thing. Like, it doesn't matter what you call the file. Just make sure it's the right thing that you're saving there.
Yeah, and you gave it to me. The finished page is what counts.
Yeah, that's right. So we just want them to finish that page. That's all it is. Or in my case, finish that podcast or that audio piece they're doing.
Again, some precise person hates you right now.
The only caveat I have for my submissions is they have to be MP3s because MP3s are the most commonly used sound file out there. Audition is what we use, like you guys, InDesign, Adobe Audition is what we use for sound, and that default is the WAVE format, which is actually higher quality, so it's like a high definition sound file, like really good sound, but for podcasting it doesn't really matter. You want that when you're listening to like a full orchestra, blah blah blah, super right. high quality sound. So for podcasting, it's MP3s. You ask for the MP3s. It's, you know, some of them have a trouble with that at first with the exporting of the MP3 because the default is WAVE and you have to fool around with it to get it to go. But yeah, and then they're like, what do you want the file name to be? And I said, just put your name on it. Tell me what it is. Like, you know, but what I should say, now that we've had this conversation, I'm realizing that those students will probably have a hard time finding those files later on.
Because they all have their name in
it. So that's something that maybe we should be teaching. Yeah. Like, here's a just...
Oh my goodness.
Maybe the lesson is figure something out and stick with it. Like, that's kind of what we should be doing, right?
All
right.
This is maybe a story that I shouldn't tell because it's more embarrassing. But here's what... So when you're first working on a project, when you're organizing your emails, which is like a whole other thing, right? If you and I are talking about Dragon Nanny, whenever I'm like, oh, where's that Dragon Nanny email? Search Dragon Nanny. Mm-hmm. All the times we talk about Dragon Nanny are there. But if you have an email signature that lists books you've worked on, as soon as that book is published and it gets added to your signature, in my case, then you can never search for the title of that book ever again in your emails
because it's just everyone.
Yeah. And so I'll have to remember, like, what else did we talk about? I think he also mentioned taking the dog for a walk. Justin. Dog walk, Dragon Nanny. Oh, I'm closer, right? Yeah. He talks about his dog a lot, right?
He does talk about his dog a lot, right? Yeah.
So this is a thing that, you know, I'm so embarrassed every time because I'll so proudly be like, oh, I've got a book out. I'm adding it to my signature. Oh, I'm so like, I'm puffing my collar up and I'm feeling so great. And then I'm like, shit, I have an important email to send about this and now I can't find it. Like, it's the opposite of being a professional published person. When you behave that way.
I usually search by name. I could try to remember who I was talking to about the thing, and then I search their name. But I guess you and Justin probably have so many emails back and forth.
Oh, my God.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
You talk about so many different things, you can't possibly narrowed down by name. Like, for example, when J-Ball, Jonathan Ball, was emailing me about something. I'm producing his podcast now, by the way. I should let the audience know that I'm the proud producer of Writing the Wrong Way, which is coming back for a new season soon.
Ooh.
And we've already got lots of episodes produced, including your new agent will be on Jonathan's podcast. So we will...
Agent Emmy in the house.
That they were your agent when I was editing that episode.
They weren't yet. We hadn't signed. We hadn't signed, I don't think.
But I just think it's cool how that interaction, that one interaction with Jonathan and this person, and Emmy, at this, what was it? It was a panel?
It was like a symposium. As far as I understand it, so we may, this may be wrong, but as far as I understand it, it's like a symposium for students in publishing in a program in Toronto.
Oh, okay. Oh, and it was online, obviously.
Yeah, and they were virtually appearing.
Yeah. Well, I just love that appearance connected those two people, that connected you, and then now on the podcast, and it's actually a very good conversation about, like, it's really practical advice for people looking for an agent, much like you guys are talking about, but from the agent's point of view. So it's a really good conversation. I lost my train of thought, but that's okay.
It reminds me of, I just watched an interview with Jeff Darrow talking about being at Jean Giraud's funeral, right? Who Jean Giraud, for those of you who are into illustration, that's Mobius, right? A French, very famous illustrator. And being at the funeral, it was a, I want to say 90s something.
Okay. I
could be wrong. Sorry. I love your work. It still lives on in my library. I don't know when you passed. But... talking about how he's at the funeral, and there is a wreath from Miyazaki, there who is currently is working on The Wind Rises, I think. So he couldn't attend the funeral, and there is a gift from Otomo, like the Akira illustrator and filmmaker, and you know, and you just, I had this moment where I was like, bunch of jerks, everyone. They're just all helping each other. How dare they? So of course you would succeed if you knew all these wonderful, talented people. And yet we're doing exactly the same thing. The what happens is in this business, there are so few people upon whom you can rely to be honest and to come through with what they say they'll do, that when you find them, you cling to them like life rafts, I think. And so you can see that in many artists, you know, and we've lost a lot of Juan Gimenez also this year. We lost a lot of great artists, and you see that they all did know each other, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm holding the door open for you, but more like, wow, you came through for me in a way that when money didn't matter, the friendship mattered more. And you can just sort of see that stuff sort of going. And I didn't quite understand it when I was very young. I always kind of looked at that Byzantine way in which everyone seemed to know everyone as if it was... you know, just a way to exclude you. But I don't see it quite that way anymore. Mm-hmm. You look like you had a profound thought you were going to say, although I could only see from the bridge of your nose right to the top of your head.
No, nothing.
So we've learned
it's
something in this moment
here,
that
yeah,
you look like you're about to have profound thoughts if I can't see your mouth.
Yeah.
Well, I think
profound
this,
looks.
I think this has been Super Pulp Science, where we did talk about how genre gets made. I would implore all our listeners, new and old, to tune in regularly. They can like or subscribe. I'm sure that's a thing that can happen. They can leave comments. They can mention.
Don't forget to smash
media.
That like button.
Yeah.
I just noticed the other day that Square has a review thing.
Oh no!
Like Square transactions. Oh. They're all good, but there's like 25 unread messages on my Square credit card transaction app of people who were just like, thanks for the artwork, enjoyed the purchase, and blah, blah.
Oh, well, that's
so
good.
So did you know about this? Have you checked your Square
sure
reviews?
No.
Yeah.
This is the same time as when you figured out in the ancient days where Facebook had that thing where...
The message requests?
Yeah, message requests were different from messages
yeah
received. And, you know, I had 1 year, there was like... I don't know, like 1,000 message requests in there for different things.
All jobs.
Yeah, and many of them were jobs. And I was like, oops. But why are you messaging me on Facebook if you're trying to have a professional exchange? That doesn't seem like the place to do it. This has been Super Pulp Science, where we're all about professional exchanges. But if I haven't got back to you in email, it's because I can't remember what we were talking about, so I can't search for the message. This is Gregory Kamichek encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.